from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After the November midterm elections, Mitch McConnell could be the leader of an incoming Senate Republican majority. But first, he has to beat a surprisingly tough Democratic challenger for his own Kentucky seat. There could be fewer Democratic senators in the South, as Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, Mark Pryor in Arkansas, Kay Hagan in North Carolina face tough re-elections. And there's President Obama, not on the ballot, but still a major player and sometimes a major liability. This hour On Point, 9 weeks until the midterms. We'll look at the stakes and hot races around the country. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What races, issues, hopes will bring you out in November? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. They're out there on the hustings making their case. Earlier this month, here's Kentucky Republican, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell debating his Democratic challenger Alison Lundgren Grimes, said if Republicans take over the Senate, there'd be real change in the 2014 midterm elections.
The change agent in this race is me. I would be the leader of a new majority to begin to take America in a different direction.
The change agent, says Mitch McConnell, is me, and his opponent, Alison Lundgren Grimes. A speech here at Kentucky's Fancy Farm Picnic to argue that Mitch McConnell does not care.
I don't know what's more dysfunctional, Senator, the way you run your campaign or your Washington, D.C. After 3 decades in Washington, you've just given up. You don't care about us anymore. Thanks to you, D.C. stands for doesn't care.
It's hot out there, and it hasn't just been the summer weather. Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to On Point.
It's great to be here, as always.
Great to have you. Jonathan Martin is national political correspondent for The New York Times. He's been in Kentucky going deep on Mitch McConnell and his challenger Grimes there. Jonathan, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much.
And Amy Walter, national editor at the Cook Political Report, where they're tracking all the ins and outs, is with us. Amy, great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom.
So we've got three of the best political journalists in the country with us today. 9 weeks to go. Jonathan, what's the handicapping on the U.S. Senate? Let's just start there at this point.
I think the Republicans have a slight advantage right now to take back the majority. They need 6 seats, Tom, 3 of which in South Dakota, West Virginia, and Montana seem to be something close to locks for them. They just need to get 3 more, and the playing field has expanded this summer, and they have more room for air. Democrats have next to no room for air. So I think right now you have to give the Republicans an advantage to take those 6 seats. That said, though, I talked to a lot of strategists last week in both parties, and the recurring theme is this does not feel like 2010, where you had that Tea Party wave and really swept in a lot of Republicans across the country. This feels much more, Tom, like trench warfare, really tough, down-and-dirty campaigns that don't seem to be sort of decided right now. There's a lot of uncertainty, I think, on this Labor Day as to who's going to win in some of these states, unlike 4 years ago, where by now some of these Senate races were pretty clearly in hand for Republicans. At this point, a lot of tied races and a lot of races inside the polling margin of error.
Karen Tumulty, a GOP Senate majority looking likely but not a wave. How does that sound to you?
I would totally agree. And one thing that the Republicans have done this time that they haven't done in the last couple of cycles is that they have avoided nominating the most candidates who represent the most extreme parts of their base. The kind of candidates that if they had nominated more establishment candidates in Delaware, Colorado, Nevada, Indiana, Missouri in the last few cycles, they would have that Senate majority now. And again, I don't see any sort of obvious, candidates who are just going to completely turn off independent voters.
Amy, could it still go either way in the U.S. Senate? What do the trend lines show you?
Well, I think that Jonathan summed it up pretty well, which is the margin of error is really the issue. And if you're going to talk about the fact that you have just a handful of seats right now in play, the problem for Democrats is that they're playing defense in almost every single one of those. But for Kentucky, and we may get to Georgia as well, a place where they may have an opportunity, but it's still a very, very tough place for a Democrat. The trend lines don't look good for Democrats. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why the party that's in the White House tends to lose seats in a second term, midterm. And that's usually because at this point, voters are taking out their frustration on the sitting president, on his party. They can't take it out on him anymore. And this president right now, as we know, his approval ratings down in the low 40s nationally. But if we're talking about these red states, the states where control of the Senate is going to be determined, his approval ratings in those places are down in the 30s. So this is why the trend lines look very difficult for Democrats, because not only do they have to win in states that are traditionally Republican, but they have to do so when the president is at his lowest point in terms of his approval rating that he's been in his entire presidency.
Jonathan, how do you see the issues driving voter sentiment in this campaign season, and how do they stack up against the single issue of President Obama?
Well, that's one of the most striking parts about this election. I think somebody, I can't recall who it was, but somebody called it the Seinfeld election. It's an election about nothing. Because when elections are about everything, they're really about nothing. If you look at when voters are asked the question of what is the most important issue for you in this election, in previous election cycles, it was pretty clear what that was, whether it was the Iraq War, the economy, what have you. And it was typically somewhere in the 20s where voters said, that's the most important issue. It's very unclear now what that is, and so when that question is asked on polls, it's typically bunched up in the teens somewhere. Look, I think it's partly about the economy, which obviously showing signs of improvement. Whether or not voters are feeling that is an open question. But I think it's also about, as Amy put it, about this president. And that's the problem for Democrats. In the absence of some galvanizing issue that they can run on, the sort of default issue becomes the president. It's less about his health care law now than it was, for reasons we can talk about, but it does seem to be more about the president. And if I'm a Democrat, Tom, and I see that Labor Day speech that President Obama gave yesterday, I'm very concerned, because there's nothing really there that you can latch on to run on this fall. Yes, he was talking about the minimum wage, which Democrats have talked about in sort of in spurts this year, but they haven't really pushed aggressively, in part because the polling on it doesn't show that it has a lot of punch politically. And so there's not much for Democrats to run on, except for the extremism and the threat of the Republicans. And that, I think, could be their best issue, is trying to rouse the Democratic base by talking about what the Republicans could do and pushing the I word, impeachment. Scaring their base, I think, using that kind of language could be their most effective tool this cycle.
Here's a little bit of the sound of the president on the hustings yesterday at Labor Fest in Milwaukee in campaign mode, attacking the Republicans.
When the rest of the country is working to raise wages, but Republicans in Congress won't, it ain't right. Not only is it not right, it ain't right. When the rest of the country is working to open up more businesses, but Republicans in Congress block investments that would help more businesses grow, it ain't right.
I don't know if that's a barn burner, but it's the president's speech. Karen Tumbley, how do you see what's going to drive this vote? Issues, free-floating sentiment, what's that look like? The president and his reputation at this point?
Well, you know, if this election should have a theme. I mean, there is a huge issue out there that I think dominates pretty much everybody's conversation, at least, you know, that I run into, and even in my own family, mm-hmm. which is the complete insecurity that people have about the economy. Yes, growth is back, but, you know, you're seeing 8 out of 10 college grads not graduating without jobs. I think that, you know, jobs should be out there as a big issue, but people have so lost any confidence that Washington can actually get anything done. And neither party's really offering a big overarching plan to do anything. And I just think that people know that whoever gets elected, that what's going to happen in Washington is pretty much nothing except a lot more fighting. And that is really, you know, I think makes it hard for everybody who is not one of the most extreme partisans to feel much enthusiasm about this election at all.
Amy, we're going to look at races one by one here, but what about the overall there? That is a dispiriting notion. Does it show up in the polls? Do you see particular issues grabbing people's attention and concern? Do you see them shrugging their shoulders and saying, Washington's just a mess, forget it?
There is a tremendous amount of shrugging of shoulders. And in some ways, this does help Democrats and hurts them. So let me start with the helping them. Part of the reason that, as Jonathan pointed out, no Democrat or Republican I've spoken to has said that this is 2010. I've heard the same thing. And part of that is
It's not going to be a wave.
And part of it is that the Republican enthusiasm isn't as strong as it was in 2010. They're also dispirited for many of the reasons that Karen brought up. But what we are seeing that hurts Democrats is the fact that traditionally in an off-year election, and we're seeing this in polls, the people who do turn out, they turn out consistently, they're older, they are more conservative, and they're whiter, meaning minorities don't turn out at the same levels in an off-year as they do in a presidential year. Those things still working against Democrats. So if what we find out is that the middle, the people who are saying, I'm just sick of all of this, I'm just not going to turn out at all, if those people don't turn out, that probably hurts Democrats more than Republicans.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the midterm elections 9 weeks from today. The battle for the U.S. Senate and control of Congress for the rest of the Obama presidency. Jonathan Martin is with us, national political correspondent for The New York Times. Karen Tumulty, same for The Washington Post. And Amy Walter, national editor at The Cook Political Report. Lots of fighting and ads and kicking going on out there. Here's an interview with the Miami Herald editorial board last month. Down in Florida, there's a big race. Things are former Republican, now Democrat, Charlie Crist talked about his political evolution from Republican to Democrat and where the parties stand.
The Republican Party today, at least leadership, appears to be anti-women, anti-minority, anti-immigrant, anti-gay, anti-environment, anti-education. I mean, you go right down the line, and it's a mess. And I couldn't be consistent with how I was raised and my values and how Mom and Dad raised my three sisters and me and not become a Democrat.
Charlie Crist in Florida, back running for the State House for the governor's mansion as a Democrat now. His Republican incumbent opponent, Governor Rick Scott, attacked, well, everything about Charlie Crist.
Almost whatever Charlie Crist talks about is sort of laughable, all right? I heard today he's supposed to come out with a plan for jobs. Now, this is a guy that whatever he does, you probably should do the opposite.
Whatever he does, do the opposite. And in North Carolina, Tom Tillis, Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, has tried to tie the first-term Democratic Senator Kay Hagan to President Obama and the bad economy. There's a lot of that going on in the ads.
Math is lost on Senator Hagan. She's misleading you about me to hide her own partisan record. Kay Hagan votes with President Obama 96% of the time. She voted for $7 trillion in debt. That's math, too. And it's the difference in this election.
Jonathan Martin, you've been down in Kentucky where we have the irony of Mitch McConnell closer than he's ever been to the possibility of being the Senate leader and yet fighting for his own seat. Give us a sense of that race.
Yeah, I just had a piece in the Times Magazine last Sunday. Folks can find it online now, or if they still have their Times Magazine from Sunday.
Great piece.
In there. It's so striking, and Karen mentioned this. In the last two election cycles, Tom, the Republicans were their own worst enemy when it came to the Senate because they nominated some really flawed candidates. Well, this time, Mitch McConnell has got the candidates pretty much in every race that he wanted. But it's really his own fate that could determine whether or not he reaches his lifelong objective and becomes Senate Majority Leader. He controls, to some degree, his destiny when it comes to getting the majority. The best thing that he has going for him, Tom, is Barack Obama. President Obama is deeply unpopular in Kentucky, as, by the way, is Mitch McConnell. But President Obama is more unpopular, and it has become very tough for Democrats to win in that state when it comes to presidential elections and congressional elections because of the National Democratic brand, and that is the McConnell one-note campaign, that this is about Obama. Now, his opponent, Allison Grimes, also has a one-vote campaign. This election is about Mitch McConnell. But that's basically the Kentucky Senate race in a nutshell. Can Grimes make it about McConnell, and can McConnell make it about Obama? Not terribly substantive, uplifting stuff, Tom, but there you have it.
She's punching pretty hard at Mitch McConnell, trying to turn his long track record into an albatross. How is he? You quote somebody from the Courier Journal in Louisville saying he's lost a step. Is he nimble enough to pull it off?
That's Al Cross, who's sort of the Bigfoot of Kentucky journalism, who's covered McConnell for decades now. There's no question that Mitch McConnell at 72, going on 73 this coming winter, is somebody who perhaps is a better strategist than he is a candidate these days. And obviously, he's never been something of a great orator. And she's taking advantage of that because she certainly is charismatic. I think has an advantage in that. So she is giving him a heck of a race, raising a lot of money, in part because, national Democrats really want to beat Mitch McConnell, and that's their sort of favorite race of this year. But the question is, can Allison Grimes overcome the challenges for her party, especially in the most rural parts of that state where it's become tough for her party to win? And the coal issue, I should add, has made it especially hard. This administration's regulations in June, when it comes to coal-fired power plants, have basically given McConnell an issue on a silver platter to link Grimes to Obama. Now, Grimes points out she's against those regulations, but politically it has made it tougher for Allison Grimes.
Amy, take us way out west to Colorado. You've got Democratic Senator there, Mark Udall, attacking his challenger, and he attacking him, Cory Gardner. What's going on in that race in Colorado, up in the air, Amy?
Well, it is. This is a race that has been surprisingly close. When we talked about the field expanding, this is one of those states we're talking about. So the battle for control of the Senate, we think, is in red states. But Colorado is a purple state, even a bluish state in these last few elections. The fact that Mark Udall is in a neck-and-neck race is indicative of the fact that the environment out there for Democrats, even in states that Obama carried, is not good. Mark Udall, this is his second – this will be going into his second term if he wins re-election, up against a younger, newer member of the House, Cory Gardner. Cory Gardner considered a much better candidate than some of the others who had thought about running. And the real issue here, the question for Democrats is, can they turn out that Obama coalition in an off-year election, or can Republicans find a way to pick off some of those voters who turned out in a presidential election, voted for Obama, but now are frustrated with the direction of Washington? So this is a really important race to watch, not just for who controls the Senate, but what the electoral map is going to look like in 2016. If a Republican can't win in Colorado in a year that's this good for Republicans with a candidate as strong as Cory Gardner, that's a real, real problem for Republicans going into a presidential year.
Here's Udall ad going after his challenger, Republican Congressman Cory Gardner, on abortion and women's rights.
Congressman Gardner just doesn't get it.
For some, it's Gardner's history supporting harsh anti-abortion laws, even sponsoring a bill to make abortion a felony, including cases of rape and incest.
I want my daughter to have the same choices I do.
For others, it's Gardner's 8-year crusade that would ban birth control.
Seriously? It's 2014.
Right, women's rights there, abortion rights there. Karen Tumulty, we hear that. We heard Charlie Crist going after Rick Scott and the Republican Party, calling them anti-woman, anti-minority, anti-immigrant, anti-gay, anti-environment, anti-education. What about the Republicans' anti-mantle here? How's that working for them this time out?
Well, it's again, this is all about firing up your base. But the Florida is really complicated. I was down there last week. Well, first of all, I mean, are Florida elections ever anything but crazy? But this year, the Florida governor's race is going to be the single most expensive contest in the country. The unpopular incumbent Rick Scott is expected to spend upwards of $100 million. It's very possible Charlie Crist will have at least the half that much. And at this point, Scott's already spent a lot of that money, and Charlie Crist's numbers have really plummeted, which means the website 538 looked at it, and they said that not in the past 20 years have you seen two general election candidates go into a governor's race with such unpopularity. So it's, as you know, as Amy was suggesting, one big question is whether the old Obama machine still has any juice. And in Florida, the question is whether they will actually mobilize for a guy who last time he ran for governor was a Republican. And when I was down there on the ground, I saw a lot of indications that, that's a real possibility in Florida.
Jonathan, you've been writing off of Ferguson about how Democrats, fearing losses in Congress, are trying to rev up the African-American vote, among others, and get it out. How's that going?
Well, I think it remains to be seen how it's going. But I talked to a bunch of leading African-American Democrats last week, and in some pretty raw language, they are moving to try to hold up Ferguson as something of a reminder to African-Americans about the importance of the franchise, the importance of voting, pointing out that the voter turnout among African-Americans in Ferguson was abysmal, and that was reflected in the racial composition of that town's power structure. So I think they're going to push that very aggressively to try to get African-Americans out where it matters most, in the South, where you've got some of these states with key Senate races and a few governor's races with significant African-American populations. The flip side of this is that using that issue could also motivate some white conservatives to come out and vote. So there could be a sort of backlash to the backlash. I think that remains to be seen. What's so striking, Tom, is we're not talking about an issue that 6 months ago I think would have been dominating this conversation, if I could, and that is the Affordable Care Act. And Kentucky is a great example of why that is. There's almost a sort of mutual non-aggression treaty. Alison Grimes doesn't want to talk about it in Kentucky because you have to say the word Obama to say Obamacare. And Mitch McConnell doesn't want to talk about it that much because it's been successful in Kentucky, at least as far as the implementation goes. About half of the state's uninsured, Tom, have now gotten coverage. And so you've got candidates who, for reasons, are avoiding it now.
It must be galling for the Democratic candidate not to be able to talk about the popularity of the Affordable Care Act because you have to say Obama to say Obamacare. I mean, Karen, this is tough. Here's a state where a lot of people have picked it up. The percentage of the uninsured has fallen almost in half. That's a big deal. What is the bad odor on President Obama that has people, I mean, even in Milwaukee, you didn't see the local candidate there, you know, getting in the photos with the president last weekend. What exactly is the sharp edge of that downside with the president?
Well, I think that the Affordable Care Act has almost ceased to be about the nuts and bolts of the law. I think it has become a symbol of what Republicans argue is an overreach on the part of the Obama administration, a government that is essentially, you know, gone crazy. And that is why you see so much sensitivity right now around the immigration issue, because the president in June promised that he would be doing some executive action that would potentially make millions of people who are in this country illegally now able to stay here. And so this was all supposed to happen at the end of the summer. And this was going to be like a gigantic, you know, hand grenade, mm-hmm. right, thrown into the middle of the election season. Right now, we're hearing noises like the White House is rethinking that maybe this isn't the smartest thing to do in the middle of an election where so much is at stake. But I think the issues like the Affordable Care Act, like immigration, are really feeding into a different narrative than they were even a year ago, which is more about the role of government and the Obama administration's expansive view of that.
You've still got some out there throwing grenades on the Affordable Care Act. We were looking at Colorado. Here's an ad, a piece of an ad from the challenger to Democrat Mark Udall. This is from Congressman Cory Gardner, going after Obamacare and Mark Udall's vote.
When Mark Udall voted for Obamacare, he promised us if we liked our health care plan, we could keep it. Well, you know how that worked out. I got a letter saying that my family's plan was canceled. 335,000 Coloradans had their plans canceled, too.
the congressman's own health care canceled. There's some kind of weird gift. Will, let's get to our listeners. Colfax, Wisconsin. Willem is calling. Hi, Willem, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom and guests.
Hi.
Well, my concern is about a Senate controlled by the Republican Party is that there'll be no action on climate change or energy policy, no minimum wage, raise in the minimum wage, no equal pay for women, no choices, you know, expansion or limitation of women's family planning choices, no welfare reform, no corporate tax reform, and then cuts to Medicare and Social Security. And that's ironic because older voters, why would older voters want to vote against their own interest in this regard? And then, voting rights and attacks on voting rights. The whole Republican agenda is moving the United States to the right in a severe way. I mean, 180 national science organizations in the world say that climate change is happening, yet people like my Republican Senator Ronald Johnson doesn't even believe in it. He says it's an unproven science.
Willem, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Jonathan Martin, go to that. What I mean, you heard that laundry list that William is worried about Republican action on or lack of action on, and yet right. We're talking about Republicans taking the Senate. What's the fundamental element of that? At this point, you and Amy and Karen are saying likelihood. Right. We'll see what happens. What's driving it?
Well, I think if you do have a Republican Senate, it would probably be 51-49, maybe 52-48. Yep. It would be a very closely a divided Senate. And look, in President Obama's last 2 years, I think they would try to sort of, block some of his regulatory moves. I think there would be efforts to try to pass at least some sort of small board tax and trade issues. I'm skeptical that there could be any kind of a grand bargain on either entitlements or on an issue like tax reform. So it probably is going to mean that you're going to have more partisan polarization here in Washington for the next 2 years like you had for much of the last four. In a country as divided as it is now, the old notion that divided government offered opportunities to sort of cut deals like it did in an earlier era seems to be a thing of the past. And it looks pretty unlikely that President Obama would be able to get much done if you had a Republican Senate with a House.
Do you see an impeachment drive gaining momentum if it's an all-Republican Capitol Hill, Jonathan?
I think it's possible, Tom. Depending upon what President Obama does as far as his plans in terms of regulatory moves to try and work around Congress, I think a lot of Republican leaders would like to avoid that because of the political backlash that would come in 2016.
And I'm looking here at the National Review online. Just today they're writing, come on, make a bigger case for what you want to do, GOP. They're looking for a stronger message out of the Republican Party, not just riding on President Obama's unpopularity. Do you see more bullet points coming?
I actually, this is Karen.
Yes,
I think
please.
The biggest impediment to that, at least if you believe a lot of the people I've been talking to, is Mitch McConnell, who is sort of in the driver's seat on this. John Boehner would actually like sort of something like the Contract with America, something to run on. But Mitch McConnell is arguing, why give your opponents something to shoot at?
Yeah.
He's a savvy campaigner and has been through many campaigns. We'll see which way this one goes. Jonathan Martin with the New York Times. I know we've got to let you go. Thank you for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the midterm elections 9 weeks from today, the battle for the U.S. Senate and control of Congress for the rest of the Obama presidency. Amy Walter is with us from the Cook Political Report. Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post. Battles out there getting personal. This was July. Scott Walker's Political Action Committee in Wisconsin released a TV ad accusing his Democratic challenger, Mary Burke, of sending jobs out of Wisconsin and overseas at her father's business, Trek Bicycle Company.
Mary, Mary, quite contrary. How does your fortune grow? By making millions of dollars. Sending jobs overseas that could have been done in Wisconsin.
And it's getting, well, tricky on the President Obama front. Here's Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana running for re-election. She's been distancing herself from President Obama on immigration, climate change, Obamacare. Here's a campaign ad that first ran in April reminding voters that she pushed back against the president's moratorium on offshore drilling.
For years, she's forced Washington to respect Louisiana.
The administration's policies are simply wrong when it comes to oil and gas production in this nation.
Like stopping offshore drilling.
Nothing about this moratorium makes sense. Nothing.
So she forced it to end.
Democrat Mary Landrieu standing up in the ad there to Democrat Barack Obama. Let's hear from that neck of the woods. New Orleans, Nelson is calling. Nelson, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Glad you mentioned Mary Landrieu, and I am a Republican, and I support the Republicans taking over the Senate, because then Mary Landrieu would actually have her desire met by having energy production opened up, the Keystone Pipeline funded or allowed, and she's just trying to win re-election right now. She'll get back as a Democrat, and she'll support Obama 99% of the time like she does right now.
Nelson, we hear that you want to see more oil flowing. What else would you like to see from a Republican-controlled Capitol Hill?
I'd like to see the budget put under control. As I understand it, in Obama's 6 years, he's doubled the national debt, and that's even with Republicans standing up and trying to stop the increase in the federal budget. Very unsuccessfully, I might say, but I'm hoping with a Republican majority, they'll take some fiscal responsibility. And the answer isn't to raise taxes. I'm a middle-income person. I pay plenty taxes, so they don't need to increase my taxes to fix the budget.
Nelson, we've got it. No thanks on the spending front, and that has been a potent political element. Amy Walter, is it potent this year, the spending issue for the GOP?
You know, they're using that as an issue in some of these races, but I think the point that Nelson raised about Mary Landrieu is a really important one, which is she is sort of trapped between this rock and a hard place, right? I mean, on one hand, she's saying, hey, if you keep Democrats in the majority, look at what you get. You get all this clout. I am the chair of the very important Energy Committee, right? Louisiana Energy, big deal. At the same time, she's fighting against her own party and her president, who doesn't want to see something like the Keystone Pipeline. Well, we don't know. The president hasn't actually weighed in yet. But clearly, this is an issue that has not gotten the traction it would get if we saw Republicans in control of the Senate or a Republican president. So she has to try to balance these two things, right? It's important to have me in the majority. Even though when I'm in the majority, I can't necessarily get the things done that I want to get done.
Karen, how do you see the budget and spending issues playing out this year? European countries reined it in pretty stiffly, and their economy is not doing so well. Now President Obama looking to take credit for a little more economic growth in this country on this side of his policies. And then there was the budget impasse last year where many thought Republicans hurt themselves. Net-net, where does it stand in the midterms, Karen?
You know, and Amy may disagree here, but at least from what I've been hearing, it's almost surprising the degree to which spending and the deficit have kind of – I mean, every candidate sort of gives it lip service, but it is not the focus that it once was. And perhaps because the economy is beginning to grow, the, you know, deficit is sort of leveling off. And it also may be that everybody got scalded by, you know, the government shutdowns. But it is, again, it feels more like a box that you have to check if you're a candidate than something that is truly igniting people's passions this year the way it has in previous cycles.
Let's get Derek from New Orleans, if I may. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to say that Mary Landrieu always has a tough time winning in this red state, and I think she's going to win again. And what she's doing is tying all of this talk about cutting debt to the specifics of who gets hurt, meaning the elderly, the veterans, and the Republican narrative is government does nothing for anybody except poor black people, and it's total nonsense. But I think she'll pull it out.
Derek, we've got it. So some confidence that Mary Landrieu will still do it. Of course, it's right up in the air there. There's nothing settled there. I'm interested in Wisconsin as well, Amy. I mean, you've got lots of governor's mansions up this year. And, of course, in Wisconsin, you had one of the most what, lit up and fraught stretch of years here with Scott Walker. He's looking at a challenger here. We heard him going after her over the Trek bicycle production abroad. What do you see unfolding in Wisconsin's governor race, Amy?
Well, I love this race for many reasons, not the least of which because it has 2016 overtones. Remember, Scott Walker, the Republican governor, is being talked about, and he's not dissuading talk about this as a Republican presidential candidate. Obviously, if he loses his race, kind of takes him down a notch. Look, Wisconsin is a Democratic-leaning state, but Democrats have won there in recent years by narrow margins, and it's a very polarized state. And Scott Walker helped to intensify that polarization with the battle, as you alluded to, over collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. We saw a recall election, which he won, surprisingly, by a pretty good margin. So, but what we see now, which is unique and in this election, is that in Wisconsin, at least in the last poll, the University of Marquette, that Democrats are more motivated in this election than Republicans. And I think that's where Mary Burke gets a benefit from this polarized environment, that Democrats saying, you know, we've tried year after year to take this guy out. Now may be the year. And she really is a vehicle for the frustrations of a party in that state that says, you know, this is a governor who is more polarizing than needs to be in a state that's as Democratic as it is.
Amy, there's been a bunch of reporting lately on Scott Walker and big money, sort of wealthy money in mm-hmm. politics, in particular Club for Growth, and him and his circle soliciting in the heat of that big battle you talked about. Does that hurt? Is he inoculated on that front?
You know, that's a really good point, because if you look at sort of the legal case around him, he is not personally implicated in this. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to see a Scott Walker, you know, in handcuffs story. But there is an investigation around the way his campaign handled outreach to donors and coordination of those donors with their campaign. It doesn't look good. And in a state like Wisconsin, which has a lot of rules, very strict rules about coordination, voters there expect a different level from their elected officials than they might in some other states. I mean, I look at some of these things. Other political reporters may look at it and say it's kind of business as usual. Voters in Wisconsin may look at it as just another opportunity where Scott Walker is looking toward his own legacy rather than to what's happening in his state.
Karen, how do you see money playing out in this cycle?
Well, I was saying this is a great opportunity to talk about that, because mm-hmm. essentially the restrictions have been lifted. They practically don't exist anymore.
With Citizens United and all the rest.
Right. And also the ability of individual donors, there are no caps left on them. So we're seeing something like $200 million already in this election of outside money pouring in. People have tried to make an issue out of it. So Harry Reid is talking quite a bit about how, you know, the Republican Party is addicted to Coke, the reference being, of course, to the Koch brothers. Mm. We're seeing some big new players like Tom Steyer, the former hedge fund guy in
environmentalist
California.
Democrat supporter generally.
He's playing in a lot of these states. Mm-hmm. Thus far, what we've seen, I think the main influence of outside money has been in these Republican primaries, giving a little bit of an edge to the establishment favorites and giving them a little bit, you know, more of a shot, and fewer of these Tea Party candidates getting elected. I'm still anxious to see whether these guys are just out there fighting themselves to a draw, or whether we're going to see a new roll of money.
We had tape come out. This is from The Nation, from one of these gatherings of wealthy potential donors, with Mitch McConnell telling them, Democrats making a lot out of this, calling it his 47% Mitt Romney moment here, Allison Grimes, his opponent. But where he said on tape, it's very muffled, but he said that if they win, if he's got the majority, Republican majority, if he's the leader, he said, we'll be pushing back against this bureaucracy by doing what's called placing riders in the bill. This is when we get to spending and budget. No money can be spent to do this or to do that. We're going to go after them on health care, on financial services, on the Environmental Protection Agency, across the board. Amy, that sounds like more gridlock, or it sounds like Republicans using the levers.
So if you talk to some Democrats, they will tell you, you know, look, if we have to lose the Senate, fine, let's lose it in 2014, and this will hurt Republican chances in 2016 for a number of reasons. One, you know, for Republicans to win back the White House, they got to be able to deal with some of the issues that they've been struggling with, namely a lot of these demographic issues, right? Being able to win over voters who are not white, being able to do better among women, better among younger voters. They're not going to help themselves if their agenda is not focused on some of those issues. The other piece is that in 2016, it's Republicans who have to play defense. They have seats up. Remember, this is the class that won in 2010 in that wave year. That's who's up in 2016. They are up in very tough states like Illinois and Pennsylvania and Ohio. Do those Republicans want to be seen as obstructionists going into their own elections in what could be a tough year? So, you know, Mitch McConnell may be the leader next time around, but his job is not going to be easy, and he's got to be able to rein in the Tea Party element that wants to push the party much more to the right, push confrontation with the president. That is going to hurt Republicans in 2016 and could flip the Senate in 2016.
Karen, there was talk earlier in the summer about a Republican wave in the House. Less of that now. And part of the analysis is interesting that the GOP, with its big wins in the last with the Republican Revolution and then again in 2010, has done so much redistricting, pushing voters, you know, into kind of base blocks, that at a certain point, that's self-defeating. You can't win outside your fortress because you've shoved all the Democrats over there.
Yeah, and I think actually there are some political scientists who've done studies, though, who've talked a little bit about making the argument that the effects of redistricting are sort of overstated. And actually what's happening out there is the population itself is sorting itself out, that, you know, liberals are moving into the cities and the rural areas are dominated by conservatives. And the suburbs, you know, again, dominated by the conservatives. So – but either way, the whole problem for both parties in the House is that there just are not a lot of districts that are truly, truly in play. At this point, there's just about nothing that you can do in a red district that is so conservative it's going to get you kicked out. And there is just about nothing you can do in a blue district that's so liberal that it can get you kicked out.
I guess the point some are making is, look, get out and vote, because at least when more people vote, you're not distilled down just to base voters, and it makes some kind of movement more possible here, even if it's tough. Allison in Canandaigua, New York. Allison, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you. We've heard a lot about Mr. Governor Cuomo, who is of our state, who's got lots of national aspirations. Some people think he's spending more time on that than others. Many of us who are very ardent supporters of his have now seen a bright light in a primary person by the name of Zephyr Teachout, who I've not heard enough about nationally, who is an organizer, educator, scholar, constitutional property law professor at Fordham Law.
And she's all about the money, as I read her, Allison, what she calls corruption of money in politics.
Exactly, but she's sharp as sharp on every issue you want to speak to. I heard her on a local talk show of NPR that, and I heard her answering questions all across the board that were incredibly impressive. And not only that, but we seldom hear about when somebody's running in a primary against a force like Cuomo, of somebody like Tim Wu, who's not only a professor, also a law school professor with background in government and private industry and academics, and he's running as an independent as well for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, you've got some very interesting players there, Allison. I appreciate your call. Zephyr Teachout raising this banner pretty high, actually, though. I don't know where she is in the numbers, Karen, but she's talking very loudly about the big money in politics, saying this is straight-up corruption and it's got to end. Tough moment for that to come up with Andrew Cuomo when his anti-corruption commission kind of right. got in all kinds of hot water with him too.
Yeah, I think his biggest problem right now is the New York Times on that score.
Right.
But the other thing that might be worth bringing in here to mention is there are a few places where there are third party, where the races are so tight, and there are libertarian third party candidates on the ballot who actually have the potential to, you know, at least theoretically pull enough votes to actually swing the outcome of some of these more very close Senate races, too.
I wonder, for each, we just got a minute here, but what's at stake in this election, Karen? If it goes one way or the other, is it just gridlock either way? Do you see big motion as a result of a Republican takeover on Capitol Hill? Or if it's status quo, is there something that could happen that would or won't, depending how the election goes?
You know, I do, in my what's left of the idealistic me, hope that when if in fact you give somebody the chance to govern, they actually try to do that, and as opposed to just kind of fighting every single fight to a draw. But again,
What's the evidence for hope? We're with you, but
okay. You know what? I'm going to go with you on this, Karen, because I want to be an optimist too. Look,
all right.
there are a lot of Republicans right now that say, if we want to win in 2016, if we want any chance at all, we have to have a positive, forward-looking agenda. We can't be all about gridlock, and we can't just be about being anti-Obama. Maybe they listen. Who knows?
Well, there's nothing that breaks up the people in their bunkers like lots of people voting. if anything is going to move, I suppose it's big waves of voters stepping up and saying, you know, maybe we've been gridlocked, but we want to go this way or that. We encourage everybody to think about where they'd like to see it go, and vote on that outlook. Amy Walter with Cook Political Report. It's been great to have you with us today, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It's been fun.
And Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Always great to have you, Karen. We'll be watching your reporting right through the rest of this season. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Tom and Amy.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.